Welcome to the Newtown Big Dreams Podcast, an interview-style talk show that's your gateway to the fabulous and fascinating people who relocated to start a new life. Whether you're new to our podcast or your city, our fellow neighbors from across Canada, North America, and the entire English-speaking world share their stories of reaching new horizons and big dreams. So sit back and relax as we navigate in-depth and intimate conversations with entrepreneurs, thought leaders, executives, creatives, and anyone who can share their story about their Newtown big dreams. And now, here's your host, Luke J. Menkes.
So, Jenny, thanks for your patience today.
No worries.
A little bit of a miscommunication, but I'm glad you made it. And you came to Kelowna in 1986, left for a while. Yeah. So tell us the story of how you arrived in Kelowna in 1986.
Well, I'll err on the side of not telling you how old I was at the time. But no, I was young. I came to Kelowna with my family. We lived in Kamloops previously. Mm. My dad worked in aviation and he secured employment with Kelowna Flight Craft. Mm. So family lived kind of apart for a little bit. And then once that looked to be permanent and long term, we all relocated here in the winter of 86. And my parents were one of the first houses up past Summerhill. It was a blank street, which is now the home of Kettle Valley and everything. So, so we moved here in 86 and I've really been here ever since, except for the period of time at university, which is I went down to Vancouver with my husband to UBC and was pretty motivated to get back as soon as possible.
Right. So as soon as you left, did you want to come back?
I did. Yeah, I could not say the same thing of my husband. My husband could have very easily been a Vancouverite. He loved the big city and everything it has to offer. And that being said, we were poor, starving students, so we didn't get to take part in anything that the city had to offer.
Right.
We couldn't even afford the parking to go downtown to enjoy it. But I was pretty motivated to get back to Kelowna in his final year of university after his last final exam. Mm-hmm. I legitimately had our apartment packed before he got home and was sitting on the moving boxes waiting for him to get home.
Right.
Said, where are you going? I'm back to Kelowna.
Right.
So we relocated back here and I've never really looked back, and I know that he's happy here as well, but could have gone the other way, but I always wanted to call this home. So
would that have been like early 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 95-ish, I guess, 95 through 98 was when we were down there for university and came back. And I always knew I wanted to come back. There's something about this valley. I think it just gets in your bones.
Yeah.
But so I came back and I really wanted to work in, I had my degree in my pocket at that point, overeducated, underemployed essay writer.
Right.
As it goes. But I came back and really wanted to work in local industry, just something that would connect me more to the valley professionally. So I ended up finding my first work here in the wine industry.
Oh,
which
a lot of people started there.
I was qualified because I loved wine, so
right.
It felt like a good place to start.
But your degree was not in wine.
No. My degree was in international relations. I had originally gone into that with the idea of being a history teacher.
I see.
And then in my mind, you know, as I kind of went through that process and I wanted to do that, I didn't really occur to me that I'd be doing the same thing just to a new group, a new audience year after year. And once I started to kind of put that together, I knew that wasn't really for me, that I'm someone who always likes change and taking on new things. So teaching didn't feel like as good of a fit by the time I was finished. So I just decided to start somewhere and work my way through there. So it's kind of been a mismatch of jobs and careers along the way, but always kind of uniquely connected. And so it's been good.
Interesting. Yeah, isn't that kind of interesting how young people go to university and we've got all these ideas what we're going to do, and by the time we get to the end, it's like, maybe not. I thought it was going to be a lawyer.
It can be a bit misguided in the beginning, you know, and there's always this push to, you know, get finished high school and go to university, get finished high school, go to university.
Right.
But I think so many kids at that age are asking that sort of fundamental question of, for what?
Right.
So you go and, you know, I had an idea, but I would never say that that time in university was misplaced. It was transformational for me. It still gave me the skills I use every day in research and public speaking. And, you know, all of that came from that formal education, but I can't remember half of the actual things I learned. It's the skills that you actually, the academic skills that you take away from it.
Right.
I just had this conversation with my daughter that I think the percentage of people who know at you know, 10, 12, 15, 18, exactly what they want to be, and they stay on that course is very, very small.
Very small.
And they're the doctors and the, you know, surgeons who know. I have a cousin, he told me when he was 9 he was going to be a surgeon, and he is.
Oh, wow.
That was a straight line course.
It's rare, yeah. So you mentioned public speaking. What sorts of topics do you talk about?
Well, Kurt, I mean, right now, I think my whole career, public speaking has always just been a piece of it. It was mm-hmm. always something I was comfortable with. And as soon as you're identified as the person who's comfortable doing that, then you're naturally voluntold quite a lot that mm-hmm. you're going to be speaking in front of groups. And I did a lot of acting and stuff as when I was younger as well, local theater and stuff like that. So I've just always been someone who was comfortable going down that path, having those conversations. So over the years, largely professionally, it's been sort of the public speaking avenue for me.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently in my current career, I'm doing a lot of presenting on the project that we're working on. So I do that for Rotary groups and large events and just anywhere someone will listen, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Is the purpose of these talks to get people interested
in
the project?
It's primarily educational right now. It's mm-hmm. really, you know, the project that I'm working on is the development of a child advocacy center in here in Kelowna.
Okay.
Which
you're trying to build it.
Yeah. It's a project that's actually been underway since 2014.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of amazing people have been connected to this project over the years. And I took this role about a year ago to help spearhead the capital fundraising campaign. So mm-hmm. we're running a $6 million campaign to build it. And the challenge with that is we're a very small organization. We're not one of these sort of giant engines of, you know, efficiency and staff. We're 4 people and running this project. And it, you know, it's super interesting, but it also takes a ton of time and energy. Mm. But the biggest thing is always that community involvement. When you're building something like this, you need the community engaged and connected to it. And when you know, the subject matter for child advocacy is child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something people really want to digest and talk about at home or over dinner, or this is a tough subject matter. And if you relate to it personally in any way, it makes it even more difficult. So, you know, getting the opportunity to go out and speak about it and get people to understand what it means to work and dedicate yourself to the solution for that mm-hmm. is really powerful, but it takes time, energy and compassion, recognizing that anytime you talk about it, you know, statistically in this province, 1 in 3 people is impacted by abuse.
Right.
So either
directly or you don't know somebody.
Yeah. So if you're speaking to a group of people, it is with certainty someone in the room is impacted. And it can be really triggering to have these conversations. And I've certainly seen that. And it's pretty powerful when someone connects to it and they often don't have to say anything. You can just see it, that there's a connection. And so it makes it powerful, but also difficult to talk about.
Yeah,
particularly in public settings.
Well, tell us a bit about this project. So what is it? It's going to be a building? It's going to be a center?
So it's an actual facility. It's being built on Kirshner in the old Interior Health building. A lot of people would remember it. It's the red brick building on Kirshner Avenue.
Okay.
Beautiful spot. So it is a dedicated facility to respond to child abuse. And the best way to explain it is, you know, right now, if a child has been abused and discloses that abuse in our mm-hmm. community, there's a real ping pong ball effect that happens after that. So there's all these service agencies and organizations that need to do their job. So there's a priority element in that, but they don't work together. They work in these silos of, you know, geographical separation. So they're not really surrounding this child. These kids have to, and families have to navigate this. It's complicated. It's disjointed. It's kind of fractured. Child advocacy centers aren't new. They exist all over the world. There's over 900 of them operational in the U.S. now.
Mm-hmm.
There's 38 in Canada. And the idea is that you put all of these resources into a singular facility so that when these families are now identified as a child advocacy case,
mm-hmm.
once they get there, everything is there. So the child abuse team from the RCMP detachment will physically relocate and work from this space.
Right.
Ministry will have staff on space. Interior Health is a partner. So it's a partnership of these big agencies, which anyone who understands the nature of these sort of behemoth agencies and organizations knows that's really complicated to
stitch
that fabric together.
Yeah.
But they're all such dedicated partners of this work, and everybody recognizes there's a better way to do this really important work for these families.
Yeah.
So it's really amazing to see it coming together. And, you know, we're at the point now where kids will access this center by the end of this year,
mm-hmm.
which again, after, you know, starting in 2014, this is a long project in the making, and it's pretty exciting to see it. It's under construction now. The walls are going up. And
yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, that's a very complex topic. Mm-hmm. And your educational background is not with child abuse. So how did you come to be involved with this project?
It's a great question because there's so many people connected to this project. So the way I came to be involved is, so the project started in 2014 and was under the guidance and leadership of the Elizabeth Fry Society, who did some really important foundational work to get it started. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years ago, Kelowna Foundation came into the picture to help really spearhead the fundraising is how that started. Somebody needed to kind of step in and start that process. So Kelowna Foundation got involved. The president of Kelowna Foundation is Al Hildebrandt, who I had worked for in a previous career back in the tech sector some time ago. And so he reached out to me about a year after and asked if I would be interested in coming to help push this project along. Mm-hmm. And I said the same thing.
Yeah. What do I know? But you've got public speaking skills.
Yeah, well, what the project really needed is a team of people who were just going to be really passionate about it to help educate the community and help bring it together. The expertise in the child welfare element and the child safety is in our partnership. So it's not our job really to have anything to do with the actual child protection piece, except for to be passionately dedicated to that it matters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my role has really been in fundraising, project management, helping to bring those partners together for those conversations. But really it's just helping them to stitch together the plans that they want to make. And, you know, again, because we're not recreating the wheel here, we have the collaboration of every other center across the country. This is such a collaborative network of child advocacy centers. Their firm belief is that every community should have one. So when you call them up and say, hey, we could use an example of this, it's in your email within minutes. And so that's been really, really important for us. But yeah, so Kelowna Foundation's role is really more as a project spearhead. Eventually the CAC is its own self-sustaining entity, and we will move on and do another project at some point.
Right.
But for now, this is the only project we have time and capacity for. So
if you're giving a talk on this topic, I'm guessing you've got statistics, or what sorts of things are you informing the public?
Yeah. So the statistics are part of it. I think the most impactful thing that we talk about when we're out there, though, is getting people to really understand how the work is currently being done and why it's broken, and trying to get people really to put themselves in the shoes of a child who's found the courage to speak a really complicated, ugly truth, and then realize that we're just not doing a good enough job of helping to build that feeling of safety and security, and then see them through the process if court is involved or whatever the stages are. Mm-hmm. So really the bulk of the sort of community education we do is really to just help people understand, because I think a lot of people will sit back and think, well, yeah, but we have the RCMP and we have ministry and like we have all the pieces.
Right.
Isn't this work already being done? And it's really getting to the gist of explaining to people how it's being done, but not in a way that is child-centric. It's not putting these kids at the center of it, and then really building a network around them that identifies them as the sort of priority within every equation. So, how it changes now is when the Child Advocacy Center gets a call, that team of people is sitting around one table and can now say, what's best for this child and this family? How do we help them? How do we navigate this story? Instead of, a social worker over there and a detective over here and a prosecutor over here and a defense, there's just not cohesiveness to that. It just doesn't make sense. And for sort of relevance, I guess people who are connected or understand what Foundry is will relate to how that integrated solution makes sense. Mm-hmm. So Kelowna Foundry, are you familiar with Kelowna Foundry? So Kelowna Foundry is an integrated youth mental health support system.
Okay.
So it's located in the same building the Child Advocacy Center will be in. So it's building, they're a walk-in, immediate available services for youth mental health. So these are children, I don't want to be quoted necessarily, but I think it's 12 to 24, I'm pretty sure, is the age group that they support. And so they have all these resources, which takes the fear factor out of a teenager needing help and needing to identify that, where they can now just walk in and find resources and support. And we sit next door to it and we see the throngs of kids accessing the support.
Yeah.
And when I first toured it, all I could think of was, how was this not always the solution? It makes perfect sense that you want to make this easy for kids and you want to make it supportive and an environment that's not scary and clinical and but has that sort of child-centric nature. So a CAC is very much the same, but for abuse. It's right. It's a completely different service, but it's the notion of bringing everything into one place, mm-hmm. which is really in keeping with, you know, where healthcare as a whole is going, of taking healthcare outside the walls of hospitals and into communities. And we know it works better. It doesn't always work to have things in the sort of four square walls of what has been traditional to this point.
Right. So the Kelowna Foundation for Hope and Social Innovation, you're helping to cause this to happen.
Yeah.
And you said that once this is done, you would take on a different project.
Yeah. So Kelowna Foundation is a project-based foundation.
Right.
So it was actually kind of a dormant foundation that was sitting, you know, not really doing a great deal.
How old is it?
The foundation itself, I believe, was originally founded in 1991. And then it was kind of sitting a little bit dormant. And when Al Hildebrandt came across this project, so Al's connection to this is a very personal one. Al's niece's daughter was 6 years old, and Red Deer, Alberta was murdered in a really unfortunate family situation, murder-suicide. And Al came back from that experience really determined to find a way to make an impact, to change that kind of story in our community. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, came across the already developing Child Advocacy Center. And so he right away stepped up to say, I want to help with the fundraising for this. So essentially, the sort of short version of the story is that Kelowna Foundation had the right set of bylaws and principles to be able to act as the lead agency to start the fundraising. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time to get charitable status with CRA and all that. So that's just a process that's underway. But so it was essentially repurposed for this project. So we repurposed the Kelowna Foundation for Hope and Social Innovation initially purely to drive this project forward and act as the fundraising agency until the CAC gets its own registered charitable status. And then, you know, then they have their sort of legs under them. So yeah, the long-term vision, you know, it's really Al's kind of baby in a sense of where we see it going, but he's very dedicated to being sort of a support advocate for projects that need additional resources or support or advocacy, whatever that might be. So you know, not really certain what comes after this. This project will be pretty all-consuming for probably another year. Mm-hmm. And then they should be kind of wheels of motion will be underway and the project will take its own momentum forward. But at that point, then we'll figure out what comes next for us and where the project looks meaningful.
Yeah.
And there's never a shortage of them. I mean, there's always a gap, right, that needs to be
there's
filled.
There's always something.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the expected opening date? This center.
So I would always write it in pencil, as with all construction projects, but the actual construction is well underway. TKI is our partner in the development. They've been extraordinary. The project is actually today a little bit ahead of schedule, which is always exciting. So we expect the construction to be finished in August, late August. Then for at least all of September, there will be the sort of technology soft movement, like getting the sort of, you know, wrinkles ironed out in the actual service delivery. And then we expect the partners to be moving in sort of through September, October. Yeah. And then ideally the sort of first layer of full operations being accessible to families by the end of 2019. So, you know, maybe a little sooner, maybe a little later, but within this year for sure.
Yeah.
And then these are huge projects. So when I say that sort of first layer, you know, with child advocacy centers, you very much have to start with the basic service delivery, and then you get to start growing and expanding that service delivery over time, which is all, you know, has to do with funding and growth and the number of cases coming through. But so there's 10 years from now, it will look very different from day one, but you have to start somewhere.
Right. So how do these centers work in different cities? Does a child call? Is there a number for a child to call, or how does it?
No, it's a great question. So it, so right now, like most disclosures, you know, the disclosures can happen everywhere. Mm. A child could be disclosing to a teacher, to a daycare worker, to a parent. It depends on how that happens. The first call doesn't change. You know, if it's an immediate situation, you'd still be calling 911, right, or RCMP or whomever. If it's at school, they have a training system where they make a call through ministry. Those partner agencies develop the protocols to determine if it's a child advocacy case or not. Hmm. So this, and like a CAC is not a drop-in walk-in center. This isn't, you know, where you go for emergency services. This is every family that comes to the CAC, we will know they're coming. They'd be booked Their forensic interview is sort of the starting point for the CAC, and then the wraparound services from there. So it's really still more guided by those agencies of saying, and that's having the criteria firmly and clearly established. Yeah. And then it becomes a, yeah, this is a CAC case, mm-hmm. and it's transitioned into the Child Advocacy Center.
Right. Excellent. So do you see yourself staying with KF for a long time?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's always hard to say because, you know, when I came in board, it was very much about this project. So it's so hard to see past this project right now because, you know, I get to do a bit of work on KF and its longevity, not as much as I think Al would love me to be able to do or I would like to do because this project is so all consuming right now. It's a little bit hard to see past the project. But that's also kind of great. You know, we're such a impassioned group of people working on this project. There's really just four of us in the office working. We have some volunteers. Volunteers are a little bit hard to use right now, but we use them where we can. Well, for a couple of reasons. One, because the security protocol to be attached to the project is so strange. It's sort of highest level RCMP clearance to be even involved during the construction phase. So that's complicated because, you know, anyone, we're talking about the physical plans that every single day. So having volunteers in the office is complicated. But there's so many people putting their hand up to say, when can I help? What can I do? So, you know, we're able to use volunteers a little bit right now for things like events and, you know, fundraising stuff, but within the actual center. And, you know, you asked a few minutes ago, how do they work across the country? Every model is a little bit different. They all have elements in common, but they're a little bit different.
Depends on the city, size of the city.
The scope, the size, the funding model, like how it's actually funded, because they're all a little bit different. Some use volunteers in a highly integrated fashion, but it's also provincially a little bit different. Like your actual rules and regulations provincially vary too. So our hope is to be able to really meaningfully attach volunteers over time, but people are always so disappointed. They're like, I just want to help. And we're like, we know you do. But it's a little bit hard to put volunteers to work on it until the whole sort of operational protocol is established and the rules around volunteers are also firmly, you know, there's a protocol for that. So that's still being developed. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
I want to wish you all the best with this project.
Thank you so much. It's exciting.
It sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be great for the kids.
Yeah, it's a big change.
Can you share any statistics with us? Do you know what the situation is in Kelowna?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We get asked this question all the time, and it's actually a complicated question to answer. And part of it is because this CAC, I should qualify, the sort of catchment area of it is everything from Lake Country, Kelowna, West Kelowna, Peachland.
Okay.
So we have some sort of idea numbers from RCMP here, right? So that detachment, our child abuse team will actually live in this center now. But what we don't have is a great understanding of the case files that will come from the other three detachments yet. So really putting a number to it is complicated.
Yeah.
Also, the other thing that sort of complicates it is that right now there's no way to draw a nice circle around the information from Interior Health to do with child abuse, Ministry to do with child abuse, and RCMP to deal with child abuse because they don't share. They're not.
Right.
This will be that, right? So having a benchmark is we really can't establish a benchmark on the combined resources because they're not combined right now.
Right.
But once they are, then over a sort of 5-year period, we should be able to start telling a pretty meaningful story.
Right.
Our early expectation is that there'll be about 50 cases a month in the early stages of the current definition of what we're serving. But that only serves to grow over time as we're able to take on more and more, a broader definition of what the CAC serves to do. So a little bit complicated, but
And like you mentioned at the beginning, there's always cases where people don't get the help that they need or they're not aware of where to turn.
Absolutely.
So,
well, and a big part of Child Advocacy Centers, like the sort of outer circle of it, as you get great at all the service delivery, one of the biggest things CACs strive to be is, instead of just being a response to child abuse, starting to become that sort of disruption in the cycle of child abuse. So there's a ton of, you know, educating through the school districts and through the various detachments and starting to work with the community to educate on how do you identify the signs of abuse, you know, steps for reintegrating kids after a disclosure. And, you know, there's so many elements of that that come down the road a little bit that's really transformational. And, you know, we have the president of the chairman. So we have a board of directors for the CAC. The president and chair of that right now is Rick Oliver from the school district, which is amazing because having the school district connected to this project on such a meaningful level is huge. I mean, they are arguably the biggest stakeholder in the outcome of what this looks like. They see it every single day, more than any of us would like to think.
Right.
And so that partnership over time, we have a ton of confidence that that will really be a big, big piece of this is the work that we do with them and helping to educate community as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a website that discusses upcoming events, volunteer opportunities, project progress, things like that?
Yeah, so there is a website at cackelowna.com, and we try to keep it as up-to-date as possible, so you can go on there and learn a bit about the model and try to understand it. You can also get connected to us through volunteer forums, and the events are on there, and you know all the different things that we're doing. We also have a Facebook and Instagram, which has been a really important way of engaging the community a bit. So yeah, and some exciting things. You know, we're relatively new to the fundraising world, so that's been a learning curve. But the community, this is a very generous community. It just is a matter of bringing a cause to community in a way that people can digest it and understand it and connect to it meaningfully, which is what we're starting. You know, we're really starting to see the momentum of the community attaching themselves to this project, which is exciting.
Right. Well, anything we can do to help raise awareness of what you're doing is great. So Topps Agency nominated you.
That was nice of them. Yeah.
Right.
What an amazing group of people they are.
Yeah.
We did the short version again of the story is I did a public speaking event for the 100 Heroes.
Right.
And we won that night, and it was actually my first on this subject matter. And I took the group on a 5-minute walkthrough of as though they were a 7-year-old girl and walked them through what their experience would look like. Anyway, the fellow from Topps Agency connected with me a little bit later, and we had coffee together, and he said, you know, that really struck a chord. I haven't been able to get that talk kind of out of my head since then, and I want to help. How can we help? So Topps, along with some partners, it was Brent and Noah, fellows named Brent and Noah that helped us out. They offered to produce that speech into a shareable version for our social media.
Yeah.
Because it is such a great way to educate people is to really think, put yourself in the shoes of a child and how this path really unfolds. So that video is now on our website. People can go and watch that. So they produced that for us in very short order, understanding the sort of urgent nature we have to raise funds.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brent really felt like he said, that's your story. You really need to help people understand what this looks like because it's uncomfortable. And if you can talk about child abuse and not feel uncomfortable, then that's a problem. It should resonate and it should upset people.
Yes.
So, you know, that 5-minute talk, we went around and we filmed it everywhere and kind of put it into the spaces that these kids would have to visit. And so, yeah, I made a very meaningful gift from them. It was a donation of sorts to produce that for us. And it's been tremendously valuable for us to be able to do that. So that, yeah. And then I know that they have been pretty connected to the work we're doing since then. So
That's great.
That
so
nice.
We will share that in our show notes
along
with your website.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great.
Yeah. It was, and again, those kind of, you know, not all gifts come in the form of checks, right? Like sometimes we've had such amazing people from this community step forward to do really incredible things that have nothing to do with writing a check, but they're incredibly transformational for this project. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Would you like to nominate someone to come on the show?
Right now, in this second? yes, but I need a second. So ask me another question and I'll think about that in the back of my mind. Because there's so many people in this valley that do so much great work.
So many great people. So the criteria is someone who's connected to Kelowna. So like we've interviewed book author from Edmonton, but she comes here to write.
Right.
So she can say, I love Kelowna.
Yeah.
Right. That's one criteria. And the other is someone that you would find interesting to listen to. Could be someone you know or someone you don't know.
You know, right now my sort of frame of reference is so connected to this work that we're doing.
Yeah.
And so one of the people that really stands out for me is somebody who's been connected to our project from the beginning. Her name's Deanne Leung. She's from Stepping Stones. I don't know if you're familiar with them. That's a pediatric counseling group.
Okay.
That, you know, she does a ton of work with therapy dogs and facility dogs. So we work a lot with her right now because the integration of therapy and facility dogs into CAC is a best practices model. So we are learning a lot from her, and she's so dedicated to the work that she does with kids. And I think that it's one of those resources that people need to understand the work that they do mm-hmm. and how they're incredibly dedicated they are to delivering that work. So yeah, I would say Deanne and they're kind of a partnership, and her husband, Eric.
Deanne, that's great. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
I appreciate your time today and telling us about this project.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. We're always happy to have the opportunity to talk about what we're working on and connect people to it.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Newtown Big Dreams podcast with your host, Luke Menkes, and his authentic guests. And we love our listeners and hope you subscribe now to learn more about the amazing journeys of our incredible guests who relocated to find a new town, big dreams. And remember, make your dreams big.